Welcome to the Bogosity Podcast for the 28th of September 2015, the podcast that's safe to dance. This is your host, Shane Killian. First, an update. Last month we covered in the podcast about the song Happy Birthday to You, very much in the public domain in literal fact, if not legal, and how Warner Chappell Music was taken to court because they never had any legitimate copyright claim over it in the first place. Now the court has ruled. None of the companies that have collected royalties on the song over the last 80 years ever had a valid copyright claim. Warner Chappell never had the right to charge for it, nor Birch Tree Group, whom they had bought it from in 1988, nor Birch Tree's predecessor, the Clayton F. Summey Company. Judge George H. King ruled that the 1935 copyright that all of this was based on only granted the rights to that specific piano arrangement, not the song itself. But there is one caveat. What Judge King didn't do is declare the song in the public domain, only that the Clayton F. Summey Company never had the rights to it, and so could not have passed them on to their successors. So this does leave the door open for someone else claiming the rights to the song, although it's difficult to see who that might possibly be. Warner has a chance to appeal the ruling, although it appears doubtful they will. Now let's low-level format the news of the bogus. There's been a couple of interesting developments in the case of Kim.com and Mega Upload that we've been covering. One is the great news that the popular constitution lawyer Lawrence Lessig, who co-founded Creative Commons, has joined the defense team. In a 38-page testimony, Lessig tore apart every single aspect of the U.S.'s case. Quote, "A showing of willful criminal copyright infringement requires compact factual proof identifying a specific copyrighted work, a right of the owner that has been violated, the geographical location of the infringement, and other specific facts needed to establish a violation of United States criminal law. Such compact facts are absent here. The generalized accusations, defective and irrelevant allegations, scattered facts of alleged multiple infringements, and statistics set forth in the superseding indictment and record of the case do not satisfy requirements of proof, but rather manifest unreliability of the overall approach." He pointed out that three of the four counts are now outside the 3-year statute of limitations, one of the terms in the U.S.-New Zealand extradition treaty. Moreover, he pointed out that the crime they're accusing the Mega Upload defendants of doesn't even exist. Quote, "Many allegations in the superseding indictment appear to attempt to allege secondary copyright infringement. Such allegations may be relevant in a civil case alleging secondary infringement, but they cannot be a basis for criminal charges of direct copyright infringement. Congress has never defined a crime of secondary copyright infringement. The Mega Upload cloud service is a dual-use technology capable of substantial non-infringing uses and thus protected by the Sony Doctrine. Under civil copyright law, internet service providers, such as Mega Upload, do not have a duty to investigate potential infringement. There is no showing of specific criminal willful infringements committed by specific individual users. There is an even more serious lack of evidence of communications between respondents, and such alleged users need to prove an agreement that is subject to laws of conspiracy. The United States Constitution prohibits the United States DOJ from prosecuting, as they apparently want to do here, a new kind of criminal conspiracy based on defendants providing an environment of infringement or their failing to disable all links to an allegedly infringing copy. Under the approach of the DOJ, many online operations and even individual persons would, without notice, suddenly become subject to criminal prosecution. General allegations of fostering an environment cannot substitute for the requisite agreement or for the necessary willful mental state of the alleged conspirator. It is my opinion that the superseding indictment and record of the case filed by the United States Department of Justice do not meet the requirements necessary to support a prima facie case that will be recognized by United States federal law and subject to the U.S.-New Zealand extradition treaty. Respondents' actions were not prohibited by criminal statutes of the United States. Filings of the DOJ attempt to create a false impression of criminal guilt and are not reliable. Hopefully Lessig's arguments will be effective. We're about to find out because .com's extradition hearing is now underway after 3.5 years, delayed by several factors, including the U.S. government not allowing Lessig to have access to his own funds to pay for his own defense, and other things we've covered before. The Guardian gives us the scoop on the first day of the hearing. Christine Gordon, attorney for the U.S., said that the allegation against .com is actually fraud, not copyright infringement. Quote, "When distractions are stripped away, the evidence boils down to a simple scheme of fraud. The dishonesty at the core of Mega Upload's operations may be expressed in straightforward terms. The respondents took part in a conspiracy. They deliberately introduced copyright-infringing material to their website. They deliberately preserved that material. They deliberately took steps to profit from that material and made vast sums of money." Gordon said the Skype conversations between .com and his Mega Upload partners somehow prove they're guilty of this amazing conspiracy. For example, quote, "The likeliness of us getting in trouble for some reason is getting bigger." Of course, notice how he says, "for some reason," and not whatever criminal reason he supposedly had in mind. It was clear for a long time that the U.S. government wanted to take down Mega Upload on behalf of their big corporate cronies. That's surely what .com was referring to. She also claimed that they admitted to being evil when .com Skyped, quote, "At some point, a judge will be convinced about how evil we are, and then we'll be in trouble. We have to make ourselves invulnerable." I guess Gordon skipped sarcasm class in law school. Now, I know what you're thinking. There's no way they could convict on this crap. And you're right. But all the U.S. has to do is blow enough smoke to make it appear prima facie. That's all that's required in an extradition hearing, not proof of guilt. Best of luck to .com and his team. Say, if you're tired of the promos in this podcast, well, the patrons got it early and with no ads or promos. Just go to patreon.bogosity.tv and donate at any level.
Hi, I'm Dave. You may recognize me from previous Bogosity episodes. However, I'm not here to talk about that. I'm also part of a podcast, the Superplex Brothers Podcast. Head on over to superplexbros.com. You can check out the podcast for video games and pro wrestling. We also have news, reviews, and editorials and all kinds of stuff just to talk about video games and pro wrestling and everything else that comes in between. So if you're into that, why don't you come check us out?
Okay, so we've been covering the incompetence of the TSA and how their proceedings are nothing more than security theater, and we've also covered the government's desire to have their own special way into our private encrypted transmissions and talked about the problems with that. Now, those two things have collided. The TSA has been selling, through the company Travel Sentry, special locks that airline passengers can put on their luggage. The idea is that passengers can lock their luggage while still allowing TSA to search it, because if the TSA has to break the lock, that makes people's luggage vulnerable to thieves. The way it works is that each customer gets his own unique key that works only in his lock, or can set his own combination, but the TSA has a set of master keys that can be used to open any Travel Sentry TSA lock. You see, it's the same idea as the encryption. Users have their own keys, but government gets its own special golden key that lets them in. What have security experts been saying? That this is a single point of failure, and anything that lets the government in can let the bad guys in too. This idea has been mocked and poo-pooed by politicians and their state apologists. TSA official Ken Lauterstein said the keys were, quote, "practical solutions that contribute toward our goal of providing world-class security and world-class customer service." Except now, it's happened. You can download online plans to make your own TSA master keys with a 3D printer. And the sad thing of it is, neither the TSA nor the keymaker's website had to be hacked and special secret blueprints or whatever stolen to make it. They were reverse engineered from pictures of the master keys that were published in the Washington Post. And what's more, the TSA doesn't even seem to care. TSA spokesperson Mike England told The Intercept, quote, "The reported ability to create keys for TSA-approved suitcase locks from a digital image does not create a threat to aviation security. These consumer products are peace-of-mind devices, not part of TSA's aviation security regime." In other words, they admit that it's nothing but security theater. Quote, "Carried and checked bags are subject to the TSA's electronic screening and manual inspection. In addition, the reported availability of keys to unauthorized persons causes no loss of physical security to bags while they are under TSA control. In fact, the vast majority of bags are not locked when checked in prior to flight." So, let's get this straight. You made these keys so that people could securely lock their luggage. Then, when it turns out that they can't securely lock their luggage, since anyone on the internet can get the keys, you say it doesn't matter. Well then, what was the point of having these keys to begin with? Of course, security experts have long known that these locks were crap. Matt Blaze told Wired magazine that he sometimes picks his own TSA lock because it's faster than looking for the actual key. The parallel to cryptographic backdoors should be immediately obvious, and it illustrates precisely the problem experts have been pointing to this whole time. But what's scary is how the government is responding to this increasing opposition to government backdoors. That's in reaction to the White House backing off their plans to get Congress to deal with the problem of everyone having access to secure encryption on their communications devices. The reason why is because they're wanting to put the kibosh on the idea that the U.S. is wanting to increase surveillance at the expense of online security. Gee, where would people ever get that idea from? They also stated that they wanted to repair the trust the world has in the U.S. government and undercut claims that the U.S. government is using big corporations as tools of mass surveillance. Even though they are. How they think this will help them in this regard is a mystery. I mean, they're already ignoring the Constitution to do it without congressional approval anyway. So Robert S. Litt, second general counsel of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, said last month in an email acquired by the Washington Post, quote, "The legislative environment is very hostile today. It could turn in the event of a terrorist attack or criminal event." He also said that they were, quote, "keeping our options open for such a situation." In other words, they're hoping for another terrorist attack to push their bogus back doors on us. And they're saying this ahead of time, ready to pounce on it, before they even know whether or not having a back door would have helped them prevent it. They do not care about keeping us safe, people. They only care about what power they can grab for themselves and seek any excuse to grab more of it. If you're on the Wi-Fi in a coffee shop or hotel, anyone on that network can get your traffic. Do you really trust all of those strangers? For that matter, do you really trust your ISP? A VPN can protect you from prying eyes, disguise your location, and even foil government censors. It's essential in this day and age, so go to vpn.pagosity.tv and you'll be taken to BoxPN. Starting at just $2.99 a month, you can get unlimited high-speed connections to VPN servers all over the world, and they don't log connections, so your privacy is assured. Traveling abroad, just VPN home, and don't worry about what those other governments are doing. Back at home, stop your ISP from traffic shaping and messing with the quality internet access you're paying good money for. You can connect from multiple machines at once, including your smartphone or tablet, and it supports all the secure standards, including OpenVPN and SSTP. Bypass sensors and surveillance with your own secure VPN connection. Go to vpn.pagosity.tv. Well, as we've covered before, all this NSA spying stuff has been going on for a while now, and George W. Bush was no innocent in all of this. In fact, he retroactively tried to declare it legal just because he, as president, said so. So it's long been known about the hospital room showdown on March 10th of 2004, where White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez and Chief of Staff Andy Card faced off against Attorney General John Ashcroft and Acting Attorney General James Comey, who is now the current FBI director under Obama. Yeah. Change? I don't think so. Over the issue of domestic surveillance and collection of the internet and email metadata of Americans, Comey, Ashcroft, and then FBI Director Robert Mueller threatened to resign, and President Bush overruled Gonzalez and Card. Now, thanks to a Freedom of Information Act request from the New York Times, we know a lot more about what happened. The day after this confrontation, Bush tried to retroactively legalize this blatantly unconstitutional domestic surveillance. But hey, what's one more violation of his oath of office on the pile? What happened was, Bush signed a new authorization for mass surveillance of internet records, but said that Gonzalez had the power to certify it instead of the Attorney General. The document also says, quote, "The President's explicit assertion that the exercise of his Article II Commander-in-Chief authority displaces the provisions of law, including the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and Chapter 119 of Title 18 of the United States Code, FISA cannot be read to infringe upon the President's Commander-in-Chief authority under Article II of the Constitution during wartime." Of course, it wasn't during wartime because Congress hadn't declared war against anybody, but details, details. The constitutional contention is about how government can acquire information. Bush got around that by redefining the word acquire. Quote, information is acquired for purposes of subparagraph 4b above when and only when the Department of Defense has searched for and retrieved such information for retention. The March 11th document also states that it was always this way all the time. Quote, the newly drafted distinction reflects the consistent course of conduct under such presidential authorizations that has been known to and authorized by me and shall be deemed to have been a part of such presidential authorizations as if paragraph 4B, 1, and 2 had been explicitly included in such presidential authorization at the time of presidential signature. Any action taken prior to presidential signature is ratified and confirmed. In other words, since Bush has been consistently behaving as though this were the law, it must have been the law. And the documentation also explicitly says that it was this that gave NSA Director Michael Hayden the go-ahead to keep spying on Americans with impunity. Sorry, but you're not going to get any change at all with any Democrat or Republican. To think otherwise is to just turn a blind eye to all of history. Hackers, terrorists, the NSA. But I repeat myself. Your online security is under attack, and the weakest point is your password. That's why you need LastPass. LastPass plugs into your browser and allows you to randomly generate strong, unique passwords anywhere on the web, all protected by one master password. LastPass sets up in minutes and gives you secure automatic logins throughout the web, synchronizing across all your browsers and all your computers, at home, at work, or on the road. It even securely stores sensitive form data, including credit card numbers. Backup sensitive documents, membership info, Wi-Fi logins, and more. And with LastPass Premium, you can get these benefits on other applications and even mobile devices, and also get priority customer support. Sign up at password.bogosity.tv for a free month of LastPass Premium. Log in securely everywhere using the last password you'll ever have to remember. Go to password.bogosity.tv and get LastPass now. And now it's time to pile on this week's Biggest Bogon Emitter. And this week it goes to Patrick J. Lynch, president of the NYPD Police Union, for the biggest bunch of apologetics we've seen since William Lane Craig. This was written in response to former tennis star James Blake being attacked by a plainclothes officer of the NYPD because the officer thought Blake had committed credit card fraud, which isn't even a violent crime. Not to mention the fact that Blake, who is black, isn't even the suspect in the case. The NYPD made some half-assed apology to Blake, but Lynch is having none of it. He titles his letter, "An Open Letter to All of Those Inclined to Jump to Conclusions." Yeah, because that must be what happens whenever someone criticizes an officer for not doing his job, like making sure someone is the right suspect before committing blatant police brutality. His salutation to all armchair judges leaves just as much to be desired. But check out his first paragraph, quote, "If you have never struggled with someone who is resisting arrest or who pulled a gun or knife on you when you approached them for breaking a law, then you are not qualified to judge the actions of police officers putting themselves in harm's way for the public good." In other words, the only people who are fit to judge the police are the police. Gee, isn't that convenient? I guess the only people fit to judge mobsters are other mobsters. You can't judge a child molester unless you're a child molester. And you'd better not complain about the cab driver you get unless you're a licensed driver yourself. Come on, when has that bogus claim ever applied? No, this is nothing more than apologetics. No different than when Christians say you have to already believe in the Bible to understand the Bible, and therefore all of the criticism of atheists are invalid as a result. No difference, people. Really, we don't need to read any further. I mean, we will, but we don't need to see what this guy is doing. Not the courts, not the press, not the lawmakers, not the voters, not anyone can judge a cop unless they're a cop too. Nice. Quote, "It is mystifying to all police officers to see pundits and editorial writers whose only expertise is writing fast-breaking personal opinion and who have never faced the dangers that police officers routinely do come to instant conclusions that an officer's actions were wrong based upon nothing but a silent video. That is irresponsible, unjust, and un-American. Worse than that, your uninformed rhetoric is inflammatory and only serves to worsen police-community relations." Hey, Lynch, Don't you think it's more likely to be the reprehensible behavior of bad police officers that's worsening police community relations? Not to mention the actions of people like you, who are always trying to defend them? Quote, "The men and women of the NYPD are once again disheartened to read another knee-jerk reaction from ivory tower pundits who enjoy the safety provided by our police department without understanding the very real risks that we take to provide that safety. Due process is the American way of obtaining justice, not summary professional execution called for by editorial writers." You mean like the due process your officer denied to Blake? Jeez. This smacks of the apologetic screed from Jack Nicholson's character in A Few Good Men, where he talks about how they can't handle the truth in order to cover for the negligent and reprehensible actions of those under his command. Lynch's screed is no different. Man, remember when Aaron Sorkin was a good writer? I don't think anything else needs to be said. It's obvious that only Patrick J. Lynch could be this week's biggest bogon emitter. Now you can make Amazon purchases with Bitcoin by going to purse.bogosity.tv. That's P-U-R-S-E. Moreover, most purchases can be made at a discount. Save an average of 20% just by buying from Purse, or get even greater discounts by linking your Amazon wish list. Go to purse.bogosity.tv. Bogosity.tv is a participant in the Amazon Services LLC Associates Program, an affiliate advertising program designed to provide a means for sites to earn advertising fees by advertising and linking to Amazon.com. Just clear your cookies and go to Amazon.bogosity.tv, or check the right-hand side of the podcast page for Amazon's best deals, including the deal of the day and limited-time lightning deals on all sorts of great products. So next time you buy online, go to Amazon.bogosity.tv. And now let's devolve this week's
Idiot Extraordinaire.
And this week it goes to PETA, who, in addition to being one of the most corrupt and evil organizations in existence since the Nazis went down, takes the prize for most unbelievable copyright bullshit ever. It was Warner Chappell, but they don't have the rights to Happy Birthday anymore. So back in 2011, photographer David Slater left his camera on the ground for a moment when a macaque, that's a kind of monkey in case you're a member of PETA and therefore don't know the first thing about animals, named Naruto, picked it up and took a selfie. Of course, it got spread all over the internet. Well, idiotically, the monkey selfie got DMCA takedown notices despite the fact that a work must have human authorship in order to be copyrightable. And this has come up before with things like elephant paintings and music. People have tried to sell those online, which is legal, but then claim copyright over others who tried to do likewise, which isn't, because the work wasn't created by a human, but an elephant. Likewise, works of nature aren't copyrightable either. You hear me, companies that are trying to copyright genes? Slater tried to claim authorship, but failed because he wasn't operating the equipment. If someone uses your phone or camera to take a picture, the picture belongs to them, not you. Well, when Slater's claim to have a copyright on the image failed, that's when PETA stepped in. PETA is saying the photo is copyrighted by the monkey. I kid you not. Well, PETA, tell you what. When the monkey files a DMCA takedown all on his own, we'll grant this one to you. Not until then. The sad thing is that the Copyright Office has already weighed in on this. In Section 313.2 of their Compendium of U.S. Copyright Office Practices, they state, quote, "This office will not register works produced by nature, animals, or plants." We're assuming that humans don't count as animals here, even though we technically are. But what's their very first example listed? Quote, "A photograph taken by a monkey." But that hasn't stopped PETA from filing a copyright lawsuit on the monkey's behalf. Hey, PETA, got a signed statement from the monkey saying he's retained you as counsel? I didn't think so. In their complaint, they say, quote, "Naruto has the same right to own and benefit from the copyright in the monkey selfies in the same manner and to the same extent as any other author." Well, PETA, the same manner would be monetarily. Do macaques use money? Of course, they're requesting that the court not only grant copyright to the monkey, but allow PETA to administer it on Naruto's behalf. But even if we were to grant their insane idea that the monkey has a copyright on the picture, Why should PETA get to administer it, and not, for example, the Humane Society? Sounds to me like PETA wants to profit at the expense of animals, but then what else is new? But as we pointed out 2 weeks ago, the statute of limitations on copyright claims is 3 years. So even if we allow their insane claims that the monkey owns the copyright, and even if we allow their equally insane claim that they legally represent the monkey and even have some weird kind of power of attorney, they still couldn't assert the copyright because it's been over 4 years. Boo to PETA, and boo as well to their copyright trolling law firm, Irrell & Manella. Here's a question. In the extremely unlikely scenario that you win, but don't share the moolah with a macaque, could Naruto sue PETA? You reap what you sow. All of that makes PETA unbelievably ahead of the pack as this week's
Idiot Extraordinaire.
Well, that wraps up this. Gamera is really neat. Gamera is filled with meat. We've been eating Gamera edition of the Bogosity Podcast. As always, you can come to forum.bogosity.tv to read the show notes and join the discussion. This podcast depends on you to keep going, so please donate using the links on the website or at patreon.bogosity.tv. And feel free to join in by sending a question, statement, news article, or rant to podcast@bogosity.tv. You can even stick it in an audio file if you want. Thank you for listening. Until next time, here's a quote from Edward Snowden. When we've got these people who have practically limitless powers within a society, if they get a pass without so much as a slap on the wrist, what example does that set for the next group of officials that come into power? To push the lines a little bit further, a little bit further, a little bit further, and we'll realize that we're no longer citizens. We're subjects. The Bogosity Podcast is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution on Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 Imported License. Do you want answers to creationist claims against evolution? Would you like to know more about evolution yourself, or even engage creationists more directly, with actual peer-reviewed sources to back you up? My book, How Evolution is Scientific, is designed to show the basics of evolutionary theory and how it is so well supported using the scientific method. It's impeccably sourced, with references to the actual scientific material, and is arranged using the creationists' own criteria of what is scientific. Using their own arguments against them, see how evolution is scientific, but creationism is not, based on observations, accurate predictions, logic, and evidence. Get answers to common creationist claims, and even a primer on abiogenesis, the start of all life. It's all in my book, How Evolution is Scientific, available at Amazon and on Kindle, EPUB, and PDF as well. Get How Evolution is Scientific and never be taken in by creationists again.